From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, GM sues Fiat Chrysler with corruption charges involving the UAW and the late Sergio Marchionne.
A lot of what he is accused of doing was weakening GM so he could get it in a position so he could take it over.
A troubling look at the shrinking revenue that Michigan cities and towns rely on.
You know, streets, and when you look at the amenities, parks, and other features that residents want in their community, those are hard to support when we're crimped from a revenue standpoint like we have been the last 15 years.
Do students have a constitutional right to literacy? A Detroit lawsuit argues the answer is yes.
Litigation is a last resort when we're trying to think about education reform, but sometimes it is the only option that's left.
Those stories for you today on Stateside. And now, the news. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a lawsuit out of Detroit says students are being denied their constitutional rights.
Nobody's arguing, hey, these schools are great. That's not what they're considering. The question is, are they so bad that it violates the Constitution?
Later in the program, we'll dig into the right to read lawsuit and what the role is of government in providing an education to all kids. But first, a mighty big shoe has dropped in the still-unfolding UAW corruption probe. This twist involves a racketeering lawsuit that GM has filed against crosstown rival Fiat Chrysler, accusing FCA of corrupt bargaining with the UAW. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton brings us the story.
Let's start with that lawsuit. Here's how Eric Gordon with the University of Michigan Ross School of Business describes it.
It's unprecedented.
Beginning in 2009, three Fiat Chrysler executives, now in federal prison, bribed UAW officials. The aim, as one of them put it, to make union leaders fat, dumb, and happy in return for favorable contracts. The union's bargaining is supposed to result in roughly similar labor costs for all three Detroit automakers. GM says the bribes resulted in unique concessions for Fiat Chrysler, like they got to employ more lower-paid workers. Meritless, says Fiat Chrysler. GM claims billions of dollars in damages. Again, Eric Gordon.
It shows how angry GM is over what it thinks is unfair treatment, which, if it's true, is highly illegal.
Gordon says while the misconduct has already been proved,
the hard part for GM is getting a jury to believe that misconduct also resulted in the sweetheart deal for FCA.
Now, about the resignation, federal investigators looking into the bribery scheme uncovered what they believe to be new and different kinds of corruption in the union. An FBI raid of the home of then UAW President Gary Jones found, quote, wads of cash in his garage, and evidence of possible misuse of union funds. To date, Jones hasn't been charged with any crimes. The UAW executive board says Jones turned in false, misleading, and inaccurate expense records. Peter Henning is with Wayne State University's law school. He says he can't blame union members if they feel betrayed.
If I'm a UAW union member, I have to ask whether back in 2015 or 2009, whether we got sold out.
All of this is happening at an awkward time for the union and Fiat Chrysler. They're in the middle of negotiations for a new contract. I'm Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio News.
And Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has been covering all of this right from the get-go. So, Daniel, how unusual is it for one automaker filing a suit like this against a crosstown rival?
Very. You always hesitate to use the word unprecedented because you don't really know going back, but nobody can remember anything like this. I mean, this is a kind of a confrontation that I would never have dreamt would happen. It's also, I think, important to note that these are the two companies that were saved by American taxpayers in 2008 and into 2009. Both went through bankruptcy, federally induced bankruptcy, and came out financed essentially by American taxpayer money. And really, at the nub of the allegations when it comes to Fiat Chrysler is that within weeks of the new FCA emerging from bankruptcy, federal investigators report that illegal payments started to flow to charities and to union officials, and that's been something that had been going on since 2009.
And You write in your column in today's Detroit News, these corruption charges mar the legacy of FCA's late CEO, Sergio Marchionne. How so?
Well, the contention by General Motors is that he essentially was the mastermind here. I think one wag on Twitter called him Marchiavelli in terms of how he engineered this alleged scheme. And this is something that they're going to have to deal with. When Sergio died in July of 2018, Mike Manley becomes CEO and quickly is faced with a number of very serious legal issues, cooking the books on sales, diesel admissions problems, and other things and other legal challenges that they've been trying to deal with. And the final one, of course, is the federal investigation. I mean, the feds have gone so far as to allege that there was a conspiracy between the UAW as an institution and Fiat Chrysler as a corporation. Now, not just individuals, but also that the company and the union were complicit in this scheme. So Mike Manley has been faced with having to deal with that and try to cut a deal. And we've reported at the Detroit News that, in fact, they were involved in negotiations with the feds. This now would suggest that that's not going to happen, at least not in the near term, and that the costs could be astronomical.
And the timing for FCA is delicate on a couple of fronts, right? The negotiations with the UAW, but also it's on the verge of a merger, right?
Well, it's in the due diligence stage of a merger with the Group PSA of France, the maker of Peugeot and Citroën cars. And I think FCA feels that this was deliberately timed to mess with both their labor talks and with their merger talks. A couple of interesting points. One is General Motors insists to me in an interview, and they have said this also publicly, that they believed a statute, essentially in layman's terms, a statute of limitations, that they needed to file this case before the existing 2015 labor contract expired. And that expiration was yesterday. So they had to file, their lawyers felt, by yesterday in order to be able to work the case the way they needed to. And the other thing that was really interesting about this is how Fiat Chrysler found out about this. Their monthly global executive committee meeting was yesterday in London. And one of the people in the meeting got a headline from one of the news stories announcing that this had happened. They didn't know anything about it. He forwarded it on to CEO Mike Manley, who looked at it and then announced to the room what was going on. Nobody knew about it. Their lawyers didn't know about it. It took them as a total surprise.
That is head spinning. Over to the UAW, we have to have you talk a little about, as we heard in Tracy's piece, so President Gary Jones has resigned.
Mm-hmm.
You also report that retired Vice President Jack Ashton, who, by the way, was the GM director, is expected to plead guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And as I read your colleague Robert Snell's story, it was pretty staggering when this tidbit that Ashton's personal chiropractor got contracts to produce more than $15.8 million worth of union-branded trinkets. It's like I keep thinking of those folks that we heard from walking the picket line at their $250 a week strike pay.
Well, that's what the whole point about this, right? And now that you mention it, that was Rob's story. I read that again this morning on what happened to Joe Ashton. No question about it. And that's really the whole point here, isn't it? I mean, the things that these union people were buying with essentially union dues in most cases early on in this whole scandal, a lot of this was focused on the Fiat Chrysler Joint Training Center, which is funded with corporate money. And so the union would come out and say, hey, there's no union member dues implicated here. Well, fast forward, we've now found out that what they were doing out in Palm Springs and what they were doing in other cases was using union dues. And the kickbacks that Joe Ashton is accused and has pleading guilty to accepting are staggering in terms of the numbers. And the interesting thing, those watches, to our understanding, are still sitting in a warehouse somewhere in Detroit. Rusting and whatever the watches do, and they sit around for years. And I think they've been sitting around for about 5 years.
Just to kind of put a button on all of this, a line from your column today I want you to kind of dig into. The confluence of the corruption scandal and GM's historic lawsuit against a crosstown rival is no accident. Tell us more.
I've long believed, and we've been working on this and nibbling at the edges, that you have essentially, think of it as a table. Things going on underneath the table. And what was going on underneath the table was all of this corruption that has been documented by federal authorities. There have been 10 convictions, 13 or so charged. And that's when it was going on under the table. What's been going on top of the table is something we've been covering all along, which was Fiat Chrysler's evolution under Sergio Marchionne, coming out of bankruptcy, and then as early as 2012, making an advance to GM about a potential merger. And then in 2015, sending an email to Mary Barra, which is, by the way, very unorthodox for a merger proposal, to send a cold email to a rival CEO and say, hey, you want to talk about having a merger? That a lot of what he is accused of doing was weakening GM so he could get it in a position so he could take it over. The other thing that's interesting is the corruption, alleged corruption, including and up to the former president, Dennis Williams, who was an old friend of Sergio's, was in part to somehow be able to persuade the union to vote its shares that it owned in General Motors. Now, to refresh people's memories, there was a retiree healthcare trust that came out of the bankruptcy and ended up owning as much as 8% of General Motors. It was the largest single shareholder. So one of Sergio's ideas was that he would get his buddy Dennis Williams to essentially pledge those shares to back a takeover attempt of General Motors. The only problem was there was a deal with the U.S. Treasury when GM came out of bankruptcy that said that a minority shareholder, even though you're the largest shareholder, has to vote your shares with the majority. So you couldn't go off and say, yeah, I want to support a hostile takeover. And therefore, Sergio was unable to move forward with the deal, in addition to the fact that GM said, yet again, not interested.
Does this push a possible federal takeover of the UAW closer to the front burner, all of this?
Well, I think from what I understand and some of the reporting we've done and listening to acting President Rory Gamble, that is in the frame for them. He is publicly talking about that as something that they want to avoid. I think it's a very real possibility. I can't say that it's going to happen, but you got to believe it's probably a very real possibility. And I think the other thing to bear in mind here, this union went through that bankruptcy too. Okay, it had to get through it to survive, and its employers had to get through it. And what I think you see now in retrospect is a cadre of leadership that squandered that survival, that was financed by American taxpayers, and this money and was starting to flow back and forth. And whether it was Sergio Marchionne who was orchestrating the whole thing, or it was lesser officials that were still doing it, nonetheless, they got the same effect. And so here we are, and you have a foundational institution of the modern American auto industry is fighting for its own survival.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
You bet.
Coming up, revenue for Michigan municipalities is down. A new report says the state needs to step up to fill the gap.
When that next recession hits, we have so many communities in the state right now that are vulnerable to real distress, maybe even as far as bankruptcy.
That is next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Revenue, it's the lifeblood that keeps a city or a town alive. And that lifeblood took a hit for communities in Michigan during the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. The Michigan Municipal League wanted to find out if municipal revenues have recovered as our state climbed out of the recession or not. So it commissioned a study from public sector consultants to hopefully answer that question. Chris Hackbarth is Director of State and Federal Affairs for the Michigan Municipal League, and he is with us now. So, Chris, just to get us all on the same page, when we say municipal revenue, what are we talking about and where does it come from?
Well, thanks for having me on today. You know, as we look at this issue from the municipal standpoint, the state budget and local budgets are really different animals entirely. The state probably has at least a dozen different revenue sources at its disposal that rise and fall with economic activity. When we look at our local governments, you know, our cities, our villages, our townships, our counties, they really are limited to two sources. We're talking property taxes, a few communities with income taxes, and then state shared revenues, revenue sharing, we call it. And there are two pieces of revenue sharing, and one of those is our statutory piece, which is delivered through the budget process. And that, you know, when we look at property taxes and we look at revenue sharing, those two sources make up about 2/3 to 3/4 of a local government's budget. You know, that's a significant piece, and when both of those were hit the way they were in the recession, it has really damaged communities' ability to invest in themselves and attract talent and job providers.
And, you know, just to kind of reiterate what I had said at the top of our conversation, revenue is indeed the lifeblood that keeps a city or town healthy, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we get we get into issues like public safety, obviously, roads and sewer systems, water systems. But then you get into, just what are the things that will really attract people to a community, make a community vibrant? When you look at your downtowns, when you look at, streets, and when you look at the amenities, parks, and other features that residents want in their community, those are hard to support when we're crimped from a revenue standpoint like we have been the last 15 years.
So this study that you commissioned from public sector consultants tracks municipal general fund revenue trends from 2002 up to 2017, looking at 225 cities. So what is the verdict? Have municipal revenues in Michigan recovered as the economy recovered or not?
Not at all. There's a complete disconnect. When you look at, like I said, property taxes and revenue sharing, that 2/3 to 3/4 of a local government budget, we're down overall 12% over that 15-year period, adjusted for inflation. We're down 15% property tax revenue, and we're down over 37% on revenue sharing. So, you've taken those two main sources of funding local governments, funding police and fire, and we've shrunk them by, in inflation-adjusted dollars, over $300 million in that 15-year period.
That's what I was wondering about. When we hear percentage, I don't know that it always connects with people. When you can tell them how many dollars, so you're saying over $300 million.
Correct.
And when you think about, you're describing the day-to-day basis, you've done a pretty good job of kind of talking about how that impacts daily living. How about in the long run? How do the declines in revenue impact the cities and the people who live in them, looking ahead in the long run?
Well, I think everyone is expecting that, this period of economic recovery we've been in nationally, it's one of the longest in our history. It will come to an end. We have recessionary cycles. When that next recession hits, we have so many communities in the state right now that are vulnerable to real distress, maybe even as far as bankruptcy. And, that is a problem that the state hasn't faced yet. We haven't come to grips legislatively through statute. When we look at some of those things that really limit our communities and investing back in our communities, we haven't been doing those things over the last 15 years. Whereas when you look at some of the other line items in the budget, we have. The legislature's done a good job of restoring just about every budget, every line item, back to at least where we were in 2011, the last time we had a major budget reduction. Revenue sharing has not seen that same kind of focus.
Why?
That's a good question. I think that we talk about term limits. You get a lot of legislators who, they weren't part of what happened 15 years ago, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So, and it's a step away from them. It's not their responsibility. That's the local government's responsibility. They have a state budget to manage, and they're managing their state budget and investing in the priorities they see. I think it's our job, and one of the things we're doing with this report is to highlight the need to make revenue sharing and some of these other problems a priority for the legislature to address.
Your report also points out how revenue has not kept pace with inflation, so that's hurting.
Absolutely. When you look at anything that a local government does, from a hiring a police officer to operating a library or patching streets or repairing their streets, all of those costs rise over time. And when you look at the fact that we have not kept pace, not even with inflation, we're under inflation by 12% when it comes across that period of time. No community is going to be able to maintain the services that they had, and they're struggling to maintain even the pared-down level that they've got now.
And so pared-down things, there have been cuts. That phrase, cut to the bone, is often used. But we have to ask, are municipalities doing enough to fight these declines in revenue, or are they powerless?
Well, every community does the best that they can with the resources they have. They certainly want to be, effective service providers for the residents. But, you look at communities that have had to take major reductions. We've had seen the state have to step in certain communities just to provide state police support to augment their local police. We've seen foundations stepping in to support just the general operations of a community, whether you look at Kalamazoo or Flint, Detroit. You have these foundations that are doing the work that a city should be doing through their own resources. And because of the fact that they can't do it on their own, we're having to try and draw on these other sources. And that's not what we should be doing. That's not the purpose of those organizations. we need to be investing back in our communities so they can provide the basic services and then go beyond so that they can attract job providers and talent.
Chris, how does the situation with municipal revenue in Michigan's communities compare to the rest of the country?
You know, it's an interesting question because when we look at the rest of the country, it's very difficult to find any other state that is as restrictive on revenues as Michigan is for our communities. When we look at the Headley Amendment and Proposal A and the limitations on local revenue raising options that there are, Michigan really stands unique across the country. You have a couple of states like California or Colorado that have growth limiters, but even those states still allow other local options that we don't have here in Michigan. As I mentioned, we have 24 communities of the 530 cities and villages and 1,200-plus townships. Only 24 communities have a local income tax. We have no local sales tax options. We have no real other local revenue-raising options at the city level. And that really hurts when it comes to trying to diversify when you go through a recession like we did.
So what is the message to state policymakers contained in this report?
Well, it is the first message is to recognize there is a disconnect. When they look at the state's budget and they see growth and they see areas that they're investing in a state budget, they need to recognize that same growth doesn't exist at the local level. And then the question is why? Why are we disconnected at the local level and what can we do to turn that around? The first is making revenue sharing a priority in the state budget from the administration down to the legislature. And then it's looking at what are those things that are limiting a local revenue options, whether it be some of the negative interactions of Proposal A and Headley or local options so communities can chart their own course with their residents.
Chris Hackbarth, Michigan Municipal League. Chris, we want to thank you for being with us today on Stateside.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And we always love to hear from you. What stories or people are you focused on or issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio or send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. Students have a constitutional right to literacy? That question is at the heart of a Detroit lawsuit that's just been argued before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. The suit was filed in 2016 on behalf of some students from Detroit public and charter schools, arguing the substandard, awful classroom conditions, lack of certified teachers, and up-to-date textbooks keep the kids from learning to read. Aaron Einhorn is with NBC News Digital, based in Detroit. Aaron, welcome.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So recap this lawsuit for us.
So, you know, I hadn't really thought about this much before, but the United States Constitution does not contain the word education in it anywhere. None of us have a constitutional right to an education, let alone a quality education. And the Supreme Court, dating back to 1973, has found that, you know, we don't have a right to a quality education, we don't have a right to an equitable education. And advocates, parents, teachers, students over the years have primarily since then, since that Supreme Court ruling in 1973, have turned to the state courts to try to, you know, improve their access to education. But this case in Detroit, this right to read literacy case, which started in 2016, is arguing that the quality of education in Detroit is so poor, so insufficient, that children graduating from schools in Detroit are unable to participate in the constitutional rights that are guaranteed in our Constitution, including the right to vote, to serve on a jury, to participate in our democracy.
So the education is really at the root of failing to provide other constitutional rights is what this is arguing.
So, yeah, it is arguing that there is, that even though we don't necessarily have a constitutional right to a quality education, we have a constitutional right to a basic education, to an education at least sufficient enough that we can choose our candidates for president and governor.
And this Detroit case, as you say, filed in 2016. Remind us, it's kind of been, you know, twisting and turning its way through the courts. So kind of remind us of the track it's followed.
Yeah, the case was filed in 2016. And forgive me, I don't remember the exact, I think it was last year, the trial court dismissed the case, said, while it's true that conditions in Detroit schools are quite poor, and I should say that all sides in this case, nobody's arguing, hey, these schools are great. That's not what they're considering. The question is, are they so bad that it violates the Constitution? And the trial court, the district court, found that that even if the plaintiffs in this case, if the case is brought on behalf of students in Detroit, even if these students are able to prove that everything that they alleged in the lawsuit, even if they're able to prove every detail, that it still wouldn't constitute a violation. And so the district court dismissed it. And now the case is going to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, to the appeals court. And that court heard arguments at the end of October, which they are now considering.
And this suit is filed against Governor Rick Snyder, right? And now that has changed because he's no longer in office.
Right. So now it's against Governor Whitmer and also the Michigan State Board of Education.
Tell us, how has Governor Snyder's administration responded? And now it's Governor Gretchen Whitmer's administration responded to this case.
Yeah. So when Governor Snyder was in office, he argued that essentially that yes, it's true, the schools were in a difficult situation, but that it didn't violate the Constitution. So essentially, the same argument that the judge who dismissed it found, which is that there was no constitutional violation. Governor Whitmer has come in and said, actually, it's moot. That it doesn't matter as much. I mean, in addition to not violating the Constitution, they're saying, well, things have changed in Detroit. So when the case was filed in 2016, Detroit public schools were still under the control of an emergency manager.
From years of control from the state.
Right. So, for much of the past two decades, there had been some form of control of the schools that wasn't a locally elected school board. So now you have a locally elected school board. You have the action that the state legislature and Rick Snyder took in 2016, which was to restore, to create a new school district, the Detroit Public Schools Community District, which wasn't facing the huge debts that the Detroit Public Schools, the predecessor district, had been facing. They put $675 million, I believe the number was, put a lot of money into this, creating this new school district, and now you have a new superintendent. He's made changes to the curriculum, raised teacher pay, things like that. Test scores are ticking up. So they're saying, okay, you know, we're all set, we're fixed.
Not much comfort to those who filed the suit, who say that they can't read and can't succeed.
Right. And I think everybody will agree that the improvements that we've been seeing in Detroit are, you know, fairly incremental. And the lives of the children who are emerging from these schools. And I should say that the case isn't just about students who attend the Detroit Public Schools Community District. It includes charter school students as well.
And there is also a Rhode Island case. It's similar. So break it down for us. What are the overlapping themes? And then how do the Detroit and the Rhode Island case differ?
Yeah. So the case in Detroit, the plaintiffs, the students are arguing that their literacy education is subpar, that their education is so poor that they're essentially illiterate, that they're not able to read. And they're defining that somewhat broadly. It includes, you know, math and other topics. In Rhode Island, there is a similar case that has been filed where the students, the plaintiffs, are arguing that their civics education is so substandard, so poor, that they can't participate in their democracy. And they're very similar cases. They're making a similar argument, but they're making it before different courts, which means they could get a different result.
So where are we now? What's next, and what could potentially happen? Arguments have been presented to the appeals court?
Right. So the appeals court is going to consider that. And in fact, the Rhode Island case is going, I think, just to the trial court next month. So both of those cases are kind of progressing. And now we watch and wait and we see, you know, if either case is successful, It could have huge implications across the country. So it would mean that every student in every urban school district, every rural school district, any school district anywhere that felt that the quality of the education being provided was substandard would be able to bring a lawsuit under the Constitution and say, this violates my rights. So it could have sweeping implications if it's successful.
And meaning if the appeals court affirms the claim made by the students. And
then it would go to the U.S. Supreme Court, presumably.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you have if the case in Rhode Island goes a different way than the case in Michigan, right, then you're going to have when you have two appeals courts going in opposite directions, that's one of the reasons the Supreme Court might come in.
Erin Einhorn with NBC News Digital. Erin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we continue talking about the Right to Read lawsuit as we meet a couple of law professors who have researched the connection between education and the United States Constitution.
Whether a word is in there or not really isn't the question. It is, does the nature of education rise to the level that the Constitution affords it significance?
Litigation is a last resort when we're trying to think about education reform, but sometimes it is the only option that's left.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We just heard from NBC News digital reporter Erin Einhorn breaking down the 2016 Detroit lawsuit that argues the appalling conditions of Detroit schools under state emergency managers denied students their basic right to literacy. Well, now let's hear from a few people who spend a lot of time thinking about just what the role of government should be in providing an education for all students.
My name is Tanya Allen, and I'm the president and CEO of the Skillman Foundation in Detroit, Michigan. We need to make sure that our young people are equipped to have economic mobility, to be able to contribute to our tax base and support all of the other efforts that go on in society and that citizens desire. It's not just about income. We're talking about a high quality of life. We want prosperity to show up in people's paychecks, but we also want it to show up in the way that they live. And that's the role I think government ought to be playing in education.
My name is Jametta Lilly. I am the Chief Executive Officer of the Detroit Parent Network. When we think about the role of government in education, it's obviously not only to keep our children safe, but to assure that we have the appropriate resources and quality that enable all of our children to meet their full potential. I think the other part of that is the recognition on the part of government that there has been an ongoing system that's been inequitable and that there are significant differences and disparities.
My name is Joe Lehman, and I'm the president of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Why does Michigan and in fact, all of the state provide for public education by providing both funding and operating the schools? We don't do that in other ways of serving the public. For example, the food stamp program, money is provided, but we don't have government grocery stores and farms for the most part. So in education, it may be time looking down the road to say, maybe the government's role could be to fund education, but does the government have to provide education?
With us now is Derek Black. He's a law professor at the University of South Carolina, where his research focuses on constitutional law and education. And Christine Bowman, professor of law and education at Michigan State University and associate dean of MSU's College of Education. And she filed an amicus brief on behalf of the Detroit students. Christine, I want to start with you. What'd you say in your amicus brief?
Well, our amicus brief really focused on the extent to which Michigan as a state had been involved in the Detroit public schools, because that's an aspect of this case that is really unusual and very interesting in my perspective, is how the state itself could be held liable for what really the outcomes are at the district level. And so we focused on not only the web of state policies, including school finance and pensions and how districts pay for capital improvements, but also in particular what has happened in terms of the state, how they have not only Well, basically the emergency management of the school district for about 10 years. And prior to that, the fact that the school board was not elected, but was appointed by the mayor. And so the extent of state involvement within the district is really quite unusual, both within Michigan and on the national scale.
And when we think about, we talk about students represented in this case, give us an idea of the day-to-day life for these students. What was the teaching like? What were the classrooms like? And what are their lives like after graduating from Detroit schools?
Well, one thing the plaintiffs regularly say is that these are schools in name only. And so what the students in Michigan really have is a right of access to education, a right to go to some school building somewhere. And in fact, in Michigan, like in every other state, education is compulsory. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to attend a public school, but it does mean that you do need to attend school. And for most students and most families, a public school is the only real option in a financial sense. So we have students who are compelled to attend these schools. And we also have these buildings that are falling apart. The heating doesn't work, or the air conditioning doesn't work. And when we're talking about Michigan winters and hot Michigan summers, that can make a big difference, especially if the windows don't open. And we have buildings that are sometimes rat infested. And we're also talking about schools where we don't have books for all of the students, and even sometimes the books that we have are 20 or 30 years old. And also, in terms of the teaching, we have incredibly dedicated teachers, but also a shortage of teachers in this area, which led Michigan to pass a law saying that Detroit could be the only district to have full-time teachers who, in fact, are not licensed by the state. And there's, again, been a shortage of teachers, a shortage of substitutes, and in the plaintiff's complaint, at one point, they talk about a student who was in eighth grade effectively teaching a good portion of a class for certainly more than a few weeks.
That certainly does not bode well for either post-high school education or job prospects.
Exactly. And so it's not surprising under these circumstances that literacy rates are in the single digits at the schools that the plaintiffs were talking about and at a number of other schools.
Derek Black, the Constitution does not include the word education. And now everybody agrees the conditions in Detroit schools have been, through these years beyond deplorable. But does that violate someone's constitutional rights?
Well, the first thing I always say is marriage isn't in the Constitution any either, but the court has on numerous occasions recognized a fundamental right to be married, as well as a number of other things in regard to health care, et cetera. So whether a word is in there or not really isn't the question. It is, does the nature of education rise to the level that the Constitution affords it significance? With that said, what my research has shown is that education actually holds a very special place in our constitutional structure. Before we even had a constitution, Congress passed the Northwest Ordinance of 1785, laying out that every single state across this nation, the new states at least, when they formed, they'd be divided up into little chunks and into little towns and cities. And at the very center lot of every single township in this country and the new states would be reserved for public schools. So it was there from the beginning. And then my research is also focused on the fact that when we had to found our nation a second time, so to speak, following the Civil War, that Southern states' reentry into the Union was conditioned on them providing and guaranteeing public education in their constitutions. So the idea somehow that education is voluntary or not a federal concern couldn't be farther from the truth, and history clearly dispels that notion. And because it does, it's no surprise that one of the Supreme Court's most famous decisions, Brown versus Board of Education, lays out why education is so important to citizenship and other aspects of life.
What about this 1973 Supreme Court San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez, when it held the High Court held there is no constitutional right to education or to equally funded schools?
Yeah, I think that case is really an outlier if you look at it. All of the court's references to education outside of that case speak of it in very different terms. I look at San Antonio versus Rodriguez as really being a political decision that the court didn't want to get involved, and it wasn't sure how best to get involved. And to give the court a little bit of a break, if we rewound to the 70s and what we knew about school funding and what we knew about the state's role in education, things were a lot different back then. States were far less involved in education. And this idea of a fundamental right to education in state constitutions wasn't developed at all back then. We didn't have clear research showing how money matters. We didn't have state standards and accountability. And so the entire legal landscape has changed since then. And so I think the court just got it wrong, and so much has changed since then that now's the time to correct it.
Christine, the Whitmer administration says, hey, look, the state has pumped millions of dollars into Detroit schools, created the new district to educate kids without being dragged down by the debts of the old district, hired Dr. Nikolai Vitti, who's embarked on a turnaround program. So the state has addressed the concerns, has it?
Well, that's a complicated question. And Dr. Vitti and his administration, and again, the incredibly dedicated teachers in the district, have done a lot to try and turn this district around. So I want to be very respectful of what they are trying to do and what they have been able to do, especially with the infusion of state money into the Detroit district. At the same time, even though we're starting to see some turnarounds in terms of test scores, they're very early, and although things are going in the right direction, they're a far cry from what I think any of us would call acceptable. And I also want to mention that, in fact, Governor Whitmer and Attorney General Nessel both campaigned on support for this case and on support for a minimum right to literacy, effectively. And so since being elected, Attorney General Nessel has continued in that same direction, and Governor Whitmer has pivoted so that the governor is now defending this case, because, of course, originally it was Gary B. versus Snyder for our former governor, and now it's, of course, Gary B. versus Whitmer.
Derek, thoughts on that argument? What do you want to add?
Well, I would just add, I mean, I think as I've sort of focused on in my research, literacy has always been the gateway to participation in our democracy, which is why Congress in the 1780s put it at the forefront. That's why we came back to it following the Civil War, the idea that if we're going to have a functioning democracy, everyone has to know how to vote. They need to know what they're voting about. They need to understand the debate and participate in it. And if children, the overwhelming majority of them, are not getting an education that provides fundamental basic reading, they might as well not be citizens in the United States of America. I mean, that's a sad thing to say, but that is the functional position that the state of Michigan puts them in.
Christine, how long does it typically take for the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals to issue an opinion? What are we looking at?
I think at some point in the next year we'll see a decision in this case, but I don't know to give you a very specific answer to that one.
Not happening imminently, so this is something that will be a while in coming. So as we think about that decision that will eventually come, tell us what could happen first if the appeals court upholds the claims made by these plaintiffs and agrees, yes, the state of Michigan violated their constitutional rights. What then?
Well, it's important to remember that this case is at a very early stage. So when it was in the district court, the decision was about whether to dismiss the case. So there has not been any record established, effectively. The case was dismissed from court before it could ever really get started. And so if the Sixth Circuit says, yes, this is a cognizable right, then it goes back to the district court, and then the long fact-finding process and a trial ultimately follow after that.
And if the court said, yep, the lower court was right to toss it out and dismiss it, then what?
Then it looks like this one is done unless the plaintiffs appeal to the Supreme Court.
Derek, how impactful could this Detroit case, and there's a similar one from Rhode Island, how impactful could they be?
Well, they certainly would fundamentally change the right to education in the Sixth Circuit. I think it would also be important that it would be the only other case following the lower courts in Rodriguez to affirmably recognize that right. So it is a first, right, or at least one of the first in that respect. And you know, I think it gives leeway for other jurisdictions, other circuits to ultimately say, yes, we agree. I think, you know, the First Circuit would be more likely to sign on to, just as a practical matter, knowing that they're the second one to say yes to some sort of fundamental right. But because this decision is, this issue is so important, right, it reaches the lives of every child in those circuits and potentially the lives of every child in the United States, you can't see a Supreme Court not taking the case if they said yes to a fundamental right, because it couldn't be the case, to speak more specifically, it couldn't be the case that children in Detroit have a fundamental right, but children in San Antonio don't. That just doesn't make any sense to have that type of difference. So it seems to me the court would need to take up the case and decide it, which is a scary thought in some respects, but I do think the court would have to take it up at that point.
Overall, I'll agree. Go ahead.
And as Derek mentioned earlier, I want to highlight that when we're thinking about whether a fundamental right exists, the court is going to say, okay, what's the history and what's the tradition here? And also, how important is this right to all the other rights?
So we're talking about educational funding. We're talking about educational opportunity. And as you look at these cases overall, how heavy a legal lift is the student's argument, Derek?
You mean how much of a... How difficult is it going to be to validate their claim?
You got it. Yep.
Well, because of the nationwide impact that I discussed, no court is going to lightly say yes. I think it's easier to say no, to be quite honest, because there's no, at least judicial consequences for the court to stay out of it. There's consequences for children, but there's not consequences for the court. So to convince courts to become involved in public education in this way, or at least at this minimal adequacy way, you're asking a lot of courts. So I think, as I've written, you're not going to trick the court into saying yes to a fundamental right here. There's been some discussion about all of the dicta and positive language the court has used in the past. To be quite frank, I don't think any of that matters because ultimately they're asking for a huge step. And if the court's going to do it, it's going to be because there's a very sound rationale for why that right exists.
Christine Bowman, what is at stake in these cases for students like Gary B. and the others involved in this case against the state of Michigan and Governor Whitmer?
Well, in my view, we have cases like this because the state has failed children and the political processes have failed children. And so to the extent that the state is now stepping up and making good on its promise that is in the Michigan State Constitution of providing children with an adequate education, then that's very positive for the children who are not only in the Detroit district, but in districts all across our state. And in my view, again, litigation is a last resort when we're trying to think about education reform, but sometimes it is the only option that's left. So if things really are changing here in the state, and if we are able to make some significant reforms to our legislative structure, in terms of not the structure of the legislature, but if we're able to reform the system of laws that govern schools, and if we're able to think about how we create a system of laws that is more fair and equitable and that does not hit districts like Detroit quite so hard, then the children of Michigan are better served and don't have as much of a need for litigation. I think one thing that is really striking to me about this case is that there has not been a floor. And when there's not a federal floor in a lot of states, that's okay, because the state establishes a floor that is above anything the federal government might set, and that's perfectly fine.
And when you say floor, you mean like a basic standard?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when we don't have a federal floor and when we leave everything to the states, sometimes the states don't live up to their part of the bargain.
Christine Bowman is a professor of education and law at Michigan State University, and Derek Black, a law professor at the University of South Carolina. We want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Sounds great. Thanks, Cynthia.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.